Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So I'll start. So thanks to Judith Fergan and the US Consulate General in Sydney for making this function possible and for drawing our attention to Patricia McNerney's visit to Sydney. I'll introduce her very briefly. She's the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of International Security and Non-Proliferation, with delegated management of the Bureau in the absence of the Assistant Secretary. Previously, she has served as the Senior Advisor to the Under-Secretary of State for Arms Control and International Security and as his Principal Advisor on Counter-Proliferation Efforts. Patricia McNerney is a member of the Virginia Bar. She received her Doctorate in Jurisprudence from Washington Lee School of Law in Lexington, Virginia, and her BA from Boston College in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. And tonight she's going to speak to us on United States government non-proliferation policies in Asia. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson, for that kind introduction, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to speak to such a distinguished gathering. The Sydney Institute has a well-deserved reputation for addressing cutting-edge topics and hosting government officials, political observers, and other dignitaries, so I'm truly honored to be here. And this is my last event for a busy 2 days in Australia, so a good way to finish as well. Thank you. I am here today to discuss United States policy on proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and implications for the Asia-Pacific region. I'd like to begin with an overview on U.S. views on the Asia-Pacific region, with special emphasis on the strategic relationship with China. Then I'd like to discuss U.S. perspectives on specific proliferation challenges affecting the region and the strategic approaches that we've developed to counter those. In all these areas, close cooperation between the United States and Australia is vital in both senses of the term, that is, the essential nature of it, as well as fullness and life and vigor. Asia continues to ride a wave of favorable political, economic, and social trends. In recent months, there have been free and fair elections in the vibrant democracies of Taiwan, South Korea, and elsewhere, with orderly transitions of government and respect for rule of law. Asia is a place of tremendous opportunity, where economies have increased both in productivity and technical sophistication. The region now accounts for over half of the global volume of trade, and economies across Asia continue to grow rapidly. The region continues to make steps towards greater cooperation and integration, with organizations such as APEC, ASEAN, and the ASEAN Regional Forum increasing the level of interconnectivity. The United States strongly supports the democratic, economic, and security progress that has been made in Asia. There are, of course, setbacks and matters that deeply concern us. The repressive regime in Burma, for example, comes to mind. Yet taken as a whole, the overall trends must be seen as positive. A more prosperous, democratic, and cohesive Asia is in all of our interest. Ironically, these very successes have made the region an even more enticing target for states and non-state actors dedicated to the illicit trade in weapons of mass destruction, their means of delivery, and related technologies. The region's geography alone, with its major trade routes sketching from North Korea to the Mediterranean, endows it with particular importance both to proliferators and those determined to counter them. Now, as Asian economies grow, an increasing number of firms are able to manufacture or acquire essential dual-use components and to support extensive transportation resources. At the same time, proliferators are inventive in their efforts to evade detection. As a result, we continue to identify new proliferators reaching out to witting or unwitting Asian suppliers. Our challenge is to stay ahead of them and to be more active and creative in combating proliferation than they are in waging it. Another challenge facing the region now and in the future will be to guard against proliferation dangers arising from activities designed to benefit the region's peoples. Two areas of particular importance concerning this regard are biological research and development, as well as civil nuclear energy. More advanced biological laboratories and expertise in the region could be a boon to public health in the face of naturally occurring disease or biological attack. Yet we must ensure that these same facilities and scientists do not foster biological weapons proliferation through inadequate safety or security or deliberate misuse. Additionally, a number of countries in the region are considering civil nuclear power. The United States is a strong supporter of the responsible development of nuclear power to increase the supply of electricity, promote economic growth and development, and reduce reliance on fossil fuels, decreasing pollution and greenhouse gases. However, such development must be undertaken with the highest standards of safety and security, safeguards to prevent theft or diversion of nuclear materials, and incentives to guard against the expansion of enrichment and reprocessing capabilities that could support nuclear weapons programs. Before turning to some of the specific proliferation threats, I'd like to discuss China and its influential role in the region. China's rapid emergence as an economic and political power is shaping the Asia-Pacific region and the world. Consequently, China's behavior at home and abroad is increasingly the focus of international attention. As China's influence expands, there will naturally be areas where our national interests overlap. It is our desire that, through a policy of constructive engagement, those areas of overlap become opportunities for cooperation with the Chinese rather than points of conflict. There are challenges nonetheless. The United States, Australia, and others are increasingly concerned about China's military modernization programs and unanswered questions about its long-term strategic objectives and projected force levels. This lack of transparency is at variance with China's place in the international community. For example, China is the only P5 state that is increasing the size of its nuclear arsenal, yet it provides far less information about its strategic forces than do France, Russia, the United Kingdom, or the United States. The lack of openness was most apparent in January 2007 when China conducted a ground-based direct descent anti-satellite test by intercepting one of its weather satellites. The United States, as well as numerous other nations, expressed concerns about the test and the resulting large debris, a cloud of debris, which will pose an increased risk both to human spaceflight as well as satellites for decades to come. We requested an explanation of China's actions and intentions, but we have yet to receive satisfactory answers to a number of lingering questions. China's continued reluctance to adequately explain the motives behind this test and other counter space activities call into question its professed commitment to the principle of free and peaceful use of outer space. Its behavior has led many to suggest that China is pursuing a multifaceted program to develop counter space capabilities that could be used to deny others access to or operations through outer space. As this incident illustrates, one of our challenges is to avoid miscalculation and misunderstanding in our strategic relations. It also illustrates the need for us to work with China to build a common understanding of the requirements of international security and stability. Dialogue on nuclear policy and strategy is one of the most important areas in which transparency and substantive exchange can help mitigate confusion and prevent miscalculation. The United States, therefore, is seeking greater insight into the direction, scope, and motivations of China's strategic programs and military modernization through diplomatic exchanges and increased dialogue with the People's Liberation Army, including the 2nd Artillery, which is responsible for China's strategic nuclear forces. Through increasingly frequent official and unofficial dialogues, we address topics with Chinese nuclear strategists and military officials that were off limits only a short time ago. I lead a regular non-proliferation dialogue with Chinese officials, and last month the U.S.-China security dialogue led on our side at the Undersecretary of State level, which brings together both diplomatic and military representatives, met for the first time in 4 years. We also work closely with China, the host of the 6-party talks, to achieve the verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, as well as in the P5+1 efforts to persuade Iran to meet its international obligations by ending its nuclear weapons efforts. Further, we engage continuously with Beijing in order to end proliferation by Chinese entities. We have made progress in that regard, but it is far from sufficient. We are working with China to make it a central part of the solution to many of the security challenges of the region. The United States, Australia, Japan, and friends and allies in China itself have made progress to that end, but the task is far from complete. Let me turn now to three pressing threats to regional and global security: Iran, North Korea, and Syria. Perhaps the most immediate threat to the international nonproliferation regime is posed by Iran, a nuclear-armed Iran with threatened states in its region and beyond. To address this very real danger, the international community has presented Iran with a stark choice between two paths, one of confrontation and isolation, or one of cooperation that leads to greater reward and prosperity. Key elements of this strategy include a multilateral pressure via escalating sanctions at the UN Security Council and implemented through national legal authorities, unilateral sanctions imposed by individual governments, including designation of Iranian banks and other entities involved in Iran's proliferation-related activity and its support for terrorism, support for the ongoing IAEA investigation of Iran's nuclear activities, the P5+1 incentives package, and the promise of wide-ranging economic and technical cooperation, including cooperation in nuclear energy, as part of a negotiated settlement of international concerns. Such negotiations can begin immediately following Iran's verified suspension of its enrichment-related and reprocessing activities. And finally, outreach to the Iranian people through exchanges, Farsi language broadcasting, and support for civil society. While our efforts have not yet persuaded Iran to suspend enrichment and reprocessing, they have, at a minimum, limited Iran's access to sensitive technologies and goods, as well as the international financial system. In time, we hope that the combination of pressure and the inducements promised by the very real incentives being offered to Iran will compel the regime to change course. The threat posed by North Korea's nuclear program has proven uniquely challenging as a threat to Asian and global security and to the global nonproliferation regime. We continue to seek the verifiable denuclearization of North Korea in the six-party talks, as agreed in the September 19, 2005 joint statement, and have met with some success in moving toward this goal. On February 13th of last year, the six parties agreed to an initial actions agreement to implement commitments made in the 2005 joint statement. Under this agreement, the North Korea shut down and sealed the Yongbyon nuclear facility with a view to its eventual abandonment. Since July of 2007, IAEA personnel have been on the ground in the DPRK monitoring and verifying the shutdown and status of Yongbyon. In October of this past year, the six parties agreed to a joint statement on second phase actions, where North Korea committed to disable all existing nuclear facilities, beginning with the three core facilities at Yongbyon. Additionally, North Korea agreed to provide a complete and correct declaration of all its nuclear programs and reaffirmed its commitment not to transfer nuclear materials, technologies, or know-how. Currently, U.S. personnel are at Yongbyon monitoring disablement activities. To date, 8 of 11 agreed disablement actions at the three core facilities have been completed. In addition, North Korea has taken actions at Yongbyon by collapsing the cooling tower. North Korea has now begun to fulfill its commitment to a complete and correct declaration by submitting that declaration to China, the chair of the six-party talks in the denuclearization working group. In return, President Bush has issued a proclamation lifting the provisions of the U.S. Trading with the Enemy Act with respect to North Korea. He has also notified the U.S. Congress of his intent to rescind North Korea's designation as a state sponsor of terror within 45 days. As part of its declaration package, North Korea has acknowledged our concerns about its uranium enrichment and nuclear proliferation activities, specifically with regard to its activities in Syria. North Korea's declaration, including its claims about uranium enrichment and proliferation activities, must now be subject to a comprehensive and rigorous verification process aimed at resolving any discrepancies and verifying the accuracy and completeness of the declaration. Additionally, an accounting of its weapons for eventual abandonment must occur in the next phase. The United States has repeatedly noted that with denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, many things are possible. The abandonment of North Korea's nuclear programs and weapons would open the way for eventual normalization of relations. and a permanent peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. This, however, cannot move forward without the full implementation of the joint statement leading to the verifiable denuclearization and North Korea's return to the NPT and its IAEA safeguards agreements as a non-nuclear weapon state. In addition, UN Security Council Resolution 1718, which imposed sanctions on Iran, will remain in effect until such time as those obligations have met, ensuring North Korea's access to the international community will be restored only upon its nuclear weapons abandonment. I cannot talk about the threats posed by North Korean proliferation without mentioning the North Korea-Syria relationship. The United States has long had concerns about North Korea's proliferation activities, and in particular, its clandestine nuclear cooperation with Syria. Based on strong evidence, the United States believes North Korea assisted with the construction of the reactor at Al-Khobar in Syria. The reactor, which was damaged beyond repair in September of 2006 of last year, appeared intended to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. We strongly support the IAEA's ongoing investigation into this cooperation. We currently do not believe that this one inspection recently completed will close the book on Syria's clandestine nuclear cooperation. It will take time, and we urge Syria to admit to the IAEA all of its nuclear activities. In addition to supporting the IAEA's ongoing investigation of Syria's activities, we have sought to address North Korea's proliferation activity through the six-party framework. We've made our concerns known to North Korea and has acknowledged these concerns. The North has stated there is no ongoing nuclear cooperation with any foreign country and that there will be no such cooperation in the future. As we begin a verification process of North Korea's nuclear declaration, we will seek to verify that this cooperation has indeed ceased. We will continue to be on the alert for signs of possible renewed cooperation. Australia has long been an indispensable partner in meeting these and other current and future proliferation challenges. More than most, it recognizes the requirement of taking a leading role to counter proliferation in Asia, and also the reality that proliferation knows no boundaries and that threats in one region are threats to us all. As the threat posed by the proliferators and terrorists has increased, so too has the ability of the international non-proliferation regimes that deal with these threats. More countries are members of the non-proliferation and export control regimes than at any point in history, and Australia has an impressive track record on leadership and support in this area. For example, in 1985, Australia proposed a meeting of countries with the aim of harmonizing national licensing measures and enhancing cooperation related to chemical weapons, and has subsequently served as the only chair of what is known today as the Australia Group for Chemical and Biological Weapons. Over the past several years, the multilateral non-proliferation regimes have found better and smarter ways to make it more difficult, costly, and time-consuming for proliferators to acquire the expertise and materials needed to advance their programs. Their efforts have caused delays, forced proliferators to use elaborate procurement networks, and compelled them to use older, less reliable technology than otherwise would be the case. This, in turn, has given us time to develop and enhance our collective abilities to create additional tools to address proliferation challenges. Indeed, the regimes remain as relevant today as they ever have been and will require our continued efforts to strengthen and adapt them. The UN Security Council resolutions against Iran and North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and Resolution 1540 that called for criminalizing proliferation with a special focus on non-state actors in some ways represent both traditional and novel international responses to proliferation. Security Council actions against threats to peace and security have been an available instrument for more than 60 years. The Council had never identified WMD proliferation in general as such a threat until it passed Resolution 1540 at President Bush's initiative in 2004. Subsequently, the several resolutions on Iran and North Korea have called for additional measures related to proliferation, as well as strong global action to deny trade and financial support, new tools to address these threats. Australia and the United States acted quickly to implement these resolutions. We welcome Australia's further unilateral actions to impede financial and transportation support to North Korean proliferation and look forward to Australia joining the United States and other countries in taking additional national action against Iranian financial institutions. We also welcome Australia's forthcoming chairmanship of the Missile Technology Control Regime and hosting the plenary here in November. As members of the IAEA Board of Governors, the United States and Australia also work closely to encourage firm positions against nuclear programs in Iran, Syria, and North Korea, and to strengthen the agency's ability to uncover illicit nuclear activities. We are now actively working to prepare for the NPT review conference in 2010. We know, of course, that your Prime Minister recently announced the creation of an International Commission on Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament in this context. The Prime Minister has indicated that the Commission will consider the issue of disarmament. The United States hopes that the Commission, as well as the review conference, will focus above all on the very real threats to the nuclear nonproliferation regime presented by irresponsible states pursuing nuclear weapons programs and the proliferators who support them. The United States is proud of our record in dramatically reducing our nuclear weapons delivery systems of fissile material for weapons. Under current plans, we will have dismantled 3 of every 4 warheads that existed in 1991, and our weapon stockpile will be at its lowest level in 50 years, lower than when the NPT was signed 40 years ago in 1968. We've also removed more than 20,000 weapons worth of plutonium and highly enriched uranium from our military stockpile. We have fewer than half the nuclear delivery vehicles now that we had in 1991. And Russia, France, and the UK have also substantially reduced their nuclear forces. China is the exception among the 5 nuclear weapons states parties to the NPT. Therefore, it is not that we wish to avoid an NPT debate focused on the 5 nuclear weapons states and disarmament actions because our arms reduction record is wanting. Instead, we wish, and the international community needs to avoid a debate that detracts attention from and impedes consensus on action to confront the very real challenges to nonproliferation. Over the past several years, the United States, Australia, and other partners have developed new forms of action against proliferation threats, not because we oppose or lack faith in the traditional instruments like the IAEA, the MTCR, and the Australia Group, but because additional flexible action is needed against continuously changing proliferation dangers. A landmark effort in that effort was the creation 5 years ago of the Proliferation Security Initiative. Australia was one of 11 participating states and has been one of the most active partners. In 5 years, the PSI has expanded to more than 90 countries and has conducted 35 exercises, including 2 hosted by Australia, to improve interdiction readiness around the world. We also appreciate the PSI outreach activities that Australia has conducted in Asia. PSI partner states have quietly cooperated to stop shipments of equipment, material, and technology for WMD or delivery systems from going to end users of proliferation concern. Interdiction actions are taken in support of the PSI consistent with national legal authorities and relevant international laws. Last month, the United States hosted a PSI 5th anniversary meeting at which over 100 countries participated either as PSI partners or as observers. We are confident that the PSI effort will continue to grow and to strengthen states' abilities to coordinate their work to stop the WMD proliferation trafficking. Australia is also an important partner in the global initiative to combat nuclear terrorism launched by Presidents Bush and Putin in July of 2006. Just 2 years later, the initiative has grown to more than 70 partner nations with both the IAEA and the EU as observers. 2 weeks ago, the Global Initiative partners met for their 4th meeting in Madrid. More than 50 countries participated, and the member states agreed on the importance of synchronizing multiple elements of our work to counter nuclear terrorism, including protection, detection, law enforcement, material search and confiscation, response, and investigation capabilities. This multilateral capacity building has been an important element in integrating our 2 counterproliferation and counterterrorism communities within our governments so that we can better address the threats posed by nuclear terrorism. Additionally, the G8 Global Partnership, established at Kananaskis in 2002, has helped broaden and multilateralize assistance related to reduction and prevention of proliferation. While the work is not yet finished, the global partnership must now expand to address threats beyond the former Soviet Union to global WMD threats. By doing so, the global partnership will provide concrete resources toward our shared objective of fighting terrorism and proliferation around the world. Lastly, I'd mention that we appreciate the partnership with Australian export control outreach efforts in the Asia-Pacific and beyond. With Japan, Australia has played a leadership role in promoting non-proliferation awareness and helping neighbors in the region develop effective export control systems. Australia has been a vital presence in multilateral export control efforts and forums around the world, including U.S.-led export control and transshipment conferences. We'll continue to count on Australian leadership in these efforts. The United States government understands the difficulties involved in all of the proliferation challenges and responses I've just outlined and are prepared to provide support and technical assistance. We've been working with many countries in the Asia-Pacific region to share information on current threats, to provide assistance to countries to help them meet their 1540 obligations, and to promote responsible development of nuclear energy and biological research and development. Through strong domestic action and the support of international partners, countries in the Asia-Pacific have started on the long but important path to a region free of WMD threats. We all aspire to an Asia-Pacific without the very real threats posed by nuclear programs in Iran and North Korea, an Asia-Pacific where information on individuals, companies, and organizations involved in proliferating WMD is collected and shared quickly, and the abuse of our commercial and financial systems is prevented, an Asia-Pacific where every country is strong and resistant to illicit trafficking of WMD materials and technologies and has the legal and regulatory structures in place to identify and prosecute proliferators. The United States is dedicated to make that vision an eventual reality, and we know that Australia is as well. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, speaking at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore in late May, outlined the U.S. enduring engagement with countries in Asia and stressed that any future U.S. administration's Asia policy, security policy, is going to be grounded in the fact that the United States remains a nation with strong and enduring interests in the region, interests that will endure no matter which political party occupies the White House next. The United States is indeed a Pacific nation, and preventing the misuse of the region's industrial capabilities and abuse of its trade, communication, and financial networks is clearly of great importance to the United States as well as regional security. Proliferation and the potential use of weapons of mass destruction is a global threat that endangers all regions and countries. And perhaps more than any policy challenge, the recognition of this threat transcends U.S. political party lines. The United States will continue to confront proliferators that threaten the international community, and we will continue to work with Australia and other partners in Asia to build up regional and global capabilities to respond to immediate challenges and detect, defend against, and deter future threats. Thank you for your time, and I'd like to answer any questions you may have.
So we come to questions and discussion. Thanks to CAUSE for the use of this fine facility tonight, and we'll finish no later than 7, but maybe a bit before. It must be very difficult in the kind of job you're in to just assess proliferation. If I could just seek your response to a couple of examples. I don't think many nations were aware of what was happening in Pakistan with Dr. Khan and what he was up to, and certainly in recent times it seems even the US was unaware of what North Korea had done with respect to Syria. Israel was probably unaware for a large part of that time too. So how do you ensure that you really know what's going on, and how difficult is it to find out what's going on?
Well, we obviously rely very heavily on our intelligence community, and our intelligence community in turn relies very much on its partnerships around the world. We rely as well on our diplomatic and partnerships and information sharing. So all of that information sort of feeds into our larger our policy discussion. getting that information is often very fragmentary, very pieced together, requires assessments based on a little bit of information here, a little there. So it's quite a challenge. And when you look at things like shipments on the move, you might get fragmentary information about the potential sensitive shipment. Part of what we've tried to do is develop the tools so that inspection of a ship becomes routine. It's not that you have to know that this is an item that's going into a WMD program, but rather you take a look at the shipment, you look at its end-use certificates, you look at whether there's indications that perhaps something is falsified. You try to kind of look beyond sort of the simple facts as they appear and sort of take that intelligence information, some of that cooperation that we've built together, and do a better job, really, at policing those kinds of activities that are going on. You take the case, a larger case of something like Syria, that was obviously going on for many years. Lots of debates whether Syria was intent on developing nuclear weapons, but not a lot of specificity, and all of a sudden there was a reactor in the desert. So I think that's a very real example of how you can miss these things for many years until potentially even too late. Fortunately, in that circumstance, that was not the case.
There's a question here.
I was just wondering, regards to your last remarks, how expensive is it to put up a nuclear reactor and get it going? You never think of Syria as an enormously wealthy industrial society able to offend a lot of, that afford a lot of weapons. Mm. And if they can do it, God knows who can do it.
That's a good point. I guess the question is often, what is a state willing to commit to a program like that? Are they, is it a priority? If it's a priority, resources get committed. However, I think if you look at some of the North Korean, even their arms, it's not the top shelf quality and the same kind of regulatory. If Australia or the United States were putting in a nuclear reactor, lots of regulatory requirements, lots of protections, lots of security. The cost much, much higher. This was pretty makeshift in terms of the quality and the nature. So the labor costs and so forth would have been much lower.
Anya, you can't get down the bottom, just down the back, just let us know, but I think it's okay. Anya, yeah.
As you say, the NPT will be up for review in upcoming years. And you did say that the US wants to avoid distracting discussion. I presume that at least in part you're referring to states like India and Israel that are known for being nuclear capable but haven't been given that status by the NPT. What kind of a status would the US be looking for countries like that in a revised treaty?
Let me clarify. We're not looking for a revised treaty. The review conference usually takes a look at the treaty, and it strengthens. It talks about implementation. We're not looking to reopen or renegotiate the treaty. And part of what I was trying to suggest is that oftentimes there can be the sense if there's not further disarmament, then we can't talk about nonproliferation. We can't talk about those that are actually violating the treaties. We'd like to keep the spotlight on those that are violating because we think that is the greatest challenge to the NPT and its continued cornerstone of our nonproliferation regime. When we talk about India and Pakistan, the U.S. continues to view them as not part of the NPT and that they should be only join the NPT as a non-nuclear weapon state, so we are not looking to give them any kind of new or different status. That said, on the India case, we have tried to see if we can't bring them further into the non-proliferation regime through our civil nuclear agreement, which will require them to add safeguards to their facilities, as well as to split out their military and their civil programs. So, on balance, we think that is a positive for the non-proliferation regime, but obviously has larger implications for their status strategically in the world.
With all the emphasis on global warming and the increasing argument that nuclear energy is a solution in many cases,
How will this affect monitoring countries' use of uranium and all of that? Is it going to make it more difficult, or is it going to open up sort of channels where there will be easier ways to check the use of such things?
Yeah. Sort of development of civil nuclear energy, particularly as fuel prices increase in the environment, has really started countries that never even thought about nuclear down that road. One of the things we've tried to do is focus our cooperation on countries agreeing, not giving up rights or foregoing rights, but rather looking to develop that nuclear energy without going down the road of some of the sensitive fuel cycle technologies, enrichment and reprocessing and the like. Recently, we signed a number of agreements, a memorandum of understanding in the Gulf states, and each of them indicated their intent not to pursue enrichment and reprocessing. And we think that really starts to shape this, to sort of limit some of the proliferation downsides of the cooperation while meeting that pillar of the NPT, which is the promise of greater civil cooperation. At the same time, obviously, having safeguards in place on these programs will be essential. The U.S., our president, has indicated that he'd like to see the additional protocol, which gives expanded IAEA access as a condition of supply for these reactors. We've also looked at, as sort of a greater reinforcement, not to go down the enrichment and reprocessing route, trying to create assured access to nuclear fuel, using the IAEA really as a focal point, but having a number of initiatives out there. One is we have downblended some of our highly enriched uranium from our nuclear weapons programs that we've decommissioned we'll have about 8 reactor loads worth of fuel, LEU, low-enriched uranium fuel for use. Russia has created an international consortium at Angarsk in Russia that they will work with the IAEA to provide access. The American NGO, NTI, has done a challenge grant, and we've donated some money looking to other countries as well to create an IAEA fuel bank. So that that also is another reinforcement to countries that, frankly, it's not economical to do some of these more sensitive fuel cycles, but it takes away the rationale for doing it if there is this assured supply of fuel. So it's that combination of safeguards measures, not doing some of the more sensitive activities. And then we have our program, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, where we're trying to look sort of long-term at enhanced technologies where you can eliminate some of the waste streams and the things that are more proliferation sensitive with better technologies and better reactors. So it's sort of a multifaceted approach. But I think this nuclear renaissance, or someone today had a different term for it, but it's here, it's happening. But we need to do it with safety, security, and protections around it. We don't think you have to play them off each other. Obviously, with any country, you have multifaceted interests and efforts and dialogues, and Pakistan is a very important partner in the war on terror, and that's an essential part of our relationship with Pakistan. That said, we very much emphasize non-proliferation policies and their need to secure their own nuclear weapons, their own nuclear materials, as well as to hold accountable those that might violate their own rules and their own laws. We push them to pass better export control laws, which they've done. We press them to keep Dr. Khan under arrest. We think that he should not be allowed to start traveling the world again, associating with those that might help reconstitute some of his former programs. So it's also very important just to show that he is being held accountable for having violated Pakistan's own trust, frankly, and its own selling its own nuclear secrets, and also obviously contributing to very serious proliferation with regard to Iran, North Korea, and Libya.
Question here. aside from the main theme you covered in your talk, you also mentioned trade and economic involvements in Asia. Now, in this context, I have a politically incorrect question. I just finished a very critical book written by an American, of course, about the Bush House, Bush administration. Also, last night, there was a cutting-edge documentary about the reconstruction of Iraq, and apparently something like $25 or $30 billion got lost and was misused and so on. And apparently many...
Hang on, look, I think we're getting a bit off the question here.
It's all related with possible economic involvement in Asia.
Can you get to your point?
My point is to prevent such unethical economic involvements, what can the government, the American government, implement to prevent a similar situation in Asia?
I guess the one important thing is whenever we have our policies and programs, we try to put the best accountability and protections around it. I can't speak to Iraq. I haven't been part of that policy. Where I do have my own bureau's money at stake is in North Korea through our Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Fund, which is funding our activities on the ground. I know that when I work our budget programs, we're very careful on how our monies are spent, where the accountability factor is, making sure that we've got appropriate records and details, and you know that's the best way to run a government program. This is obviously much more limited and focused and a much easier job, and I don't envy those who had to get in and start work in Iraq with billions of dollars flowing, but certainly that's good fiscal management, and that's how we try to run our programs.
There's a reference to a BBC Panorama program on Iraq, which was essentially a left-wing rant, and was shown out here by Four Corners without any contrary views being heard. So it was very ABC. Yeah. Yes.
How vital do you see successful engagement with China, given what you spoke about the intransigence, the present intransigence, and the super intransigence of China in the non-proliferation area? How vital is it for the next U.S. administration to successfully engage with and see successful fruit being born?
Yeah. I think it's very essential and vital. I don't want to sound too negative. I think we've actually made a fair amount of progress through engagement with China. You know, they're an indispensable party in the six-party process, indispensable in the P5+1. Even on some of the sort of real technical things like trying to get them to pass laws and do enforcement, they're making steps, they're doing better. But at the same time, the bulk of trade contributing to WMD, a lot of it is still coming out of Asian entities. You know, not the government per se, but rather these entities that aren't held accountable necessarily for some of these dual-use shipments that end up contributing to Iran's program. We press them hard. We think they need to stop selling arms to countries like Iran that are under UN Security Council resolutions. We similarly press Russia on that point. Efforts we make on sanctions. Obviously, we've been making an effort, which is we have accountability through our sanctions for companies that we see repeatedly engaged in this proliferation. But at the same time, for those that sort of do the right thing and put in practice better policies, we want to also show that these sanctions can be lifted and we can sort of rehabilitate those companies. We recently did that with a Chinese company, China Great Wall. Which has, after having been sanctioned by the United States, developed an internal compliance mechanism, put in place strict policies about its engagements and the kind of activities it's doing, and really has cleaned itself up to become a global player. And we think that's the kind of direction we want to see a lot of these large Chinese-owned state companies proceed. So it's, you know, it's a lot of dialogue, a lot of discussion, some tools and some leverage. But China is going to be a world leader. It's growing, and if their companies are going to engage with us in the global marketplace, then they need to meet some of these higher standards that the rest of us play by.
Okay, we're getting near the end, so there's a question down there, then we'll come over here. Yeah.
I wonder if you could comment on the attitude of Russia to the nuclear disarmament.
Yeah, actually, we have a pretty good record with Russian working cooperatively on I put it for non-proliferation generally. Our president's announced an initiative where we're trying to look at civil nuclear energy and provide some of the benefits of it by sort of financing infrastructure development and so forth for countries, also encourage them not to go down some of these sensitive technology paths. We've worked together to create the global initiative to combat nuclear terrorism, really focusing on that layered defense against terrorist access to fissile material and know-how and so forth. We have a regular strategic dialogue. Our presidents met in Sochi just 2 or 3 months ago and outlined a number of initiatives that we're undertaking together. We're working through the Moscow Treaty to reduce our arms. By 2012, we should be down to the lowest numbers since the Eisenhower administration. Russia, similarly, is going to be reducing those. We're talking about a follow-on START arrangement, which is to be negotiated. I think some of that work will continue, obviously, into the next administration. So things are proceeding. Whether they're doing some modernization or other kinds of activities, obviously, we would like to see them similarly support an FMCT, work to reduce their nuclear stockpile, work to be transparent and open about some of their activities as well. So I think on balance, though, it's a good record, and the objective will be to kind of keep that on the same path.
How about the really low-tech so-called dirty bomb? Mm. It's just a bomb surrounded by radioactive material. That would seem to me to be really quite easy to do and would slip through your examination.
Yeah, one of the things we work on is a lot of these detection or larger detection architecture and technologies that can sort of see some of the fissile material, radioactive material, before it's shipped to the United States, but even through our Megaports program that is run by our Department of Energy, even globally. So we're trying to sort of find those radiological sources before they obviously get in the hands of those that would have ill intent. The danger, though, is to those kinds of items that are out there, much more commonly held, not the more sensibly protected fissile material, and we have a number of programs where we try to create layer defense and sort of things that'll trip up and sort of send signals that will create law enforcement. You know, the layered defense in depth. So you have the detection architecture, you have law enforcement, you have cooperation between countries. We in Australia do a number of radiological source training courses with Southeast Asia, working with the IAEA through its smuggling response group. So there's this whole range of activities, which doesn't mean you're always going to catch things, and obviously a dirty bomb is not, it doesn't have the same impact as a nuclear weapon, but obviously it could have a detrimental...
Pretty nasty.
Yeah, pretty nasty. And so, we do the best we can with this range of programs and try to make sure that that doesn't come to pass. And then, the other side of our strategy, obviously, is for something like that to happen, how do we quickly contain it and have the least possible impact?
I have two questions. One is about North Korea. Do you think this time the North Korea will really abandon the nuclear project, or is there still possibility to cheat gas? And if there is possibility, how to prevent the cheating gas again? And the other one is the coming decades, in Asia or China, India, there is a huge plan to introduce a nuclear plant to for the coming energy demand. So how do you think that the non-proliferation policy with the situation that many Asian and African countries and the developed countries has such nuclear plants?
Yeah. In North Korea, we obviously are continue to test the proposition of their intent. They have agreed through the joint statement to abandon their nuclear weapons program. At the same time, we're making very baby steps in this action for action kind of scenario. We've at least managed to shut down the Yongbyon facility, stop the production of fissile material there. The next phase is going to get tougher. We're going to start talking about the weapons, and obviously, we've got to find the tools and the ways to continue to impact their strategic decision making. I think China is going to be essential as we move to that phase. They have a lot of ability to influence, and that's part of the secretary and the president's vision on the six parties has been, it can't just be the United States and North Korea, but we've got to have the regional players. And I don't think anyone thinks this is easy. A key component of this next phase is going to be verification. And, taking the North Koreans at their word is never a wise thing for any policymaker. We've got a track record there. So we need to verify. We need to get on the ground. We need to see these facilities, and that will be part of the strategy. On the civil nuclear, the NPT promises countries access to civil nuclear technology. So we're not... That in itself is not a proliferation worry. What is the proliferation worry is that you don't have the right kinds of protections, you don't have the right kind of safeguards, the assurances that there's no diversion from nuclear weapons, some of these sensitive materials being accessed by terrorists or being accessed by those that may not sort of understand how to appropriately protect and contain the material. So what we've tried to do is look at how we can have the highest safety security standards as these programs develop. We also think that if you don't protect these and do the right thing, you could create a situation where something obviously goes wrong with the reactor, and it's going to have people globally pulled back again from nuclear energy, which really is one of the ways that we're going to have to find alternative sources of energy that are not going to contribute to global warming, and obviously nuclear is part of that vision.
Final question, Ms. Yeah.
Probably a naive question, but isn't it true that the Western world, and America included, rely on Israel to take the strong action against these rogue states like Syria and Iran? I mean, they are prepared to threaten where the rest of democracies they've got to rely on sanctions, but Israel is much more proactive, and we all sit back and, if it wasn't for Israel, what would have happened in Syria?
Well, I think Israel obviously looks at its own national interest and its own strategic view. It sees Iran as an existential threat. I assume that it obviously relied on its self-defense and its actions in Syria. That said, I think we felt we could have worked through the IAEA and others, and taken some steps towards that reactor. So, I don't think anyone relies on Israel per se, but Israel acts in its own interest.
Just a final question. It's great to see you here, but why are you here? What's
what are you doing there?
What's your visit to do with the Australian government? What kind of discussions are you having?
I had a full day yesterday in Canberra, and it's really been a while since we as allies, we see each other at meetings, and we talk and obviously cooperate through our embassies, and lots of dialogue, and visitors come and go, but I just hadn't sat down and really had a full non-proliferation dialogue, especially with the new government. It seemed timely, and I think actually it was fortuitous also with the announcement of this commission to kind of get a sense of some of the Australian thinking, and also the debate ongoing on this government's position on civil nuclear energy. While obviously you take your domestic decisions, we also want to make sure that as it relates to some of these larger non-proliferation objectives, that we're still engaged and talking to each other. So we have some good dialogues, and as well on Iran, trying to make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of sanctions and measures. And so it was a full and productive day of meetings with the interagency in Canberra, and I get to go home tomorrow for the 4th of July.
Thanks. Thanks. Well, Ms. McNerney's talk will be on the podcast tomorrow and published in the Sydney papers in due course. I'll be very brief. As those of us here know from the Australian end, all our recent governments have been very active in the nuclear non-proliferation issue and other non-proliferation issues. It's true of the Fraser government, the Hawke government, the Keating government. It's also true of the Howard government, although it probably wasn't so well known, but it was also true of the Howard government, and now it's true of the Rudd government. And of course in Australia we have a particular interest, as does the rest of the world, in Iran, and also because of our particular part in the world in North Korea. And Christopher Hill has spoken here on a couple of occasions and briefed us on North Korea, and I hope he might be able to come back again later in the year. But we follow these matters with great interest, so it's great to have Patricia McNerney here telling us what's going on, and what's going on from the United States end, from the international end, but also Australia's involvement in this process. So many thanks for an important paper tonight. It'd be great to publish it, to podcast it, and best wishes with your endeavours. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.